This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Our first question this month comes from Peter Carr, who says, pulsars are often described as being like lighthouses, producing a beam of radiation that sweeps around as the star rotates. This implies that the beam is produced from a spot on the equator of the star. Is that correct? What mechanism is thought to produce the beam?
A pulsar is the dead heart of a star. It's produced in a supernova through a combination of gravity and compression from the nuclear explosion that happens around it. It's so dense that the atoms themselves have squashed together to become a city-sized ball of mostly neutrons called neutron star, and they're the densest things that we've observed that aren't black holes. And when you try and squash something that large, like the core of a star, into something very small, like a pulsar, strange things happen. Basic physics tells us that certain things are conserved, you can't get rid of them. And these things include the star's angular momentum and its magnetic field. So when you squash it down, it spins faster, and it gets more strongly magnetized. A star that was spinning maybe only once a year originally, or perhaps even slower, will end up rotating many times a second. And the magnetic field, which on the Sun is only barely enough to influence life here on Earth, becomes billions of times more powerful. This magnetic field is strong enough to produce a dynamo, which takes any remaining electrons and protons left on the surface of a neutron star and rip them off into space, firing them off at speeds close to the speed of light. This particle ejection is the main way that neutron stars slow down. These charged particles, we think, interact with magnetic field lines and spiral around them. As they spiral, they slowly lose energy by giving off emission all over the electromagnetic spectrum. Radio waves in particular can be very strong, and this is the emission that we see from Earth, as being continually produced by the pulsar. But why is it pulsed? If you have a look at a relatively simple magnetic field, like the Earth's, you'll see it isn't aligned with our rotation axis. The magnetic pole and the true pole aren't in the same place. If you were to stand on the magnetic pole and fire a laser into space, your laser would trace a circle amongst the constellations as the Earth rotated. Most of the sky is never covered by the laser beam, but if it happened to hit some distant world, and someone were on there looking back at us, they'd see a pulse of laser light every time the Earth turned, every 23 hours and 56 minutes. We think a very similar thing is happening on the pulsar, except we're the ones looking at it, and it's firing radio-emitting charged particles from its magnetic poles rather than a laser beam. The magnetic axis isn't on the equator, and it's not aligned with the true pole of the neutron star. It emerges from some pseudo-random spot on the neutron star. The beam still traces a circle around its own sky every time the pulsar rotates. We only see the neutron star as a pulsar if that beam hits the Earth. Most neutron stars are undetectable. So there you have it. Neutron stars send out a radar-like beam of radio waves from their magnetic poles. And if we're lucky, we happen to be underneath that beam and we can see a pulsar.
The second question is from Rob Peck, who says, Professor Paul Crowther mentioned that there was no theoretical limit as to how big a massive star may become. It made me wonder about the environment at the centre of such massive stars. How large would a star need to be before a black hole was created at its core?
Well, really massive stars are really strange places. There's no theoretical limit as to how big a star can become, but there are very definite limits as to how big a star can remain stable. Biggest stars never really finish forming by the time they die. The biggest star we know of in our galaxy is probably Eta Carinae, which began as a star of around 150 to 180 times the Sun's mass. Now it's probably only about 110 times the Sun's mass because it's lost so much mass in the catastrophic explosions, the biggest of which may have been the 19th century. A bigger star is probably the romantically named R136A1 in the Large Magellanic Cloud. It might be slightly larger, tipping the scales to around 265 solar masses. But this is probably just about the largest star we're likely to see today, and the reason for that is down to the conditions at the centre of the star. Stars support themselves because the photons of light produced by thermonuclear reactions at the centre have enough pressure to counteract the enormous pull of the star's gravity. But when you make the stars too big, you run into problems with this radiation pressure support. The energy production of the Sun ticks over very gently. It produces less heat per cubic metre than a person. The quote of the day on this one probably has to go to Wikipedia, which says that the solar centre produces about the same energy density as an active compost heap. However, unlike a compost heap, most of that energy is in X-ray photons, with typical energies of around 4 kiloelectron volts. However, if you beef up a star to about 100 solar masses, you start to encounter problems. Instead of X-rays, gamma rays are produced in the centre of the star, and these gamma rays can interact with the atomic nuclei and loose electrons so strongly that they spontaneously produce new pairs of particles, electrons and positrons. A lot of the gamma ray's energy is taken away in these particles, and the radiation pressure then can't support the star anymore. The star collapses, then explodes, in what's called a pair instability supernova. And this occurs in such a way that it leaves no remnant behind, not even a black hole. These pair instability supernovae could have been a very good way of getting a lot of heavy elements like iron and cobalt out into the cosmos early in the universe's history. If you make a star even bigger, more than about 250 solar masses, the thermal gamma rays have enough energy to smash apart the atomic nuclei, meaning that their energy never makes it out of the core of the star. Since there's no radiation to support the gravity against the star, it simply collapses under its own weight into a sizable black hole. It's possible that stars like these seeded the supermassive black holes that now reside in the centre of all large galaxies. So while there may be no theoretical limit as to how big stars become, once you get above beyond maybe 100 times the mass of the Sun, the practical limit is that stars will destroy themselves before they can fully form.
The third question is from John Brooks, and he says, would the top and bottom of a black hole look similar? Or is a black hole not a sphere but maybe coin-shaped?
That's a really good question, and it caused me to think a bit. But the answer seems to be that it comes down to whether your black hole's rotating or not. As far as we can tell, a black hole is a singularity. They've been described as where God divided by zero. Apparently nature abhors a complete breakdown of the laws of physics, so the ugly side of the singularity is shielded from us by the event horizon. If you have a Schwarzschild black hole, that's a non-rotating one, it simply sits as a point in space, surrounded by its event horizon. You'd see the same thing from every direction, which is simply a hole in space, surrounded by the distorted, gravitationally lensed images of the stars behind it. The black hole itself is just a point, and the event horizon is just a featureless sphere. There's no top, there's no bottom, it just looks the same. On the other hand, if you have a rotating black hole, what's referred to as a Kerr black hole, then you can have a much more interesting scenario. A rotating massive object drags the space-time continuum around it. It's a bit like twisting a fork in a checkered tablecloth. A rotating black hole will actually drag space-time outside its event horizon, faster than the speed of light, in a region known as the ergosphere. Matter and light can still pass through this ergosphere without being swallowed by the black hole, but only as long as it's travelling in the same direction as the black hole spins, and it will be bent on the way. Looking from the top or bottom of a spinning black hole, and you'll see the familiar Einstein ring as background stars are stretched out into arcs. Except these distorted images will also be twisted around the black hole, forming a spiral. The view from the equator is even more interesting, as the black hole takes on the kidney bean shape as light passing through the approaching side of the ergosphere is allowed through, but light on the receding side is blocked. Surprisingly, visual models of rotating black holes were only made very recently, and that's mainly thanks to the film Interstellar. This film accurately depicts a spinning black hole, which is capturing matter via an accretion disk. That accretion disk is seen to warp into unusual shapes by the black hole's spin. We often describe the peculiar appearance of this warped accretion disk. It's probably best that you see it for yourself. In the show notes, we've linked to a couple of videos which show the black hole model from Interstellar and how it was put together. They're really worth watching if you have a spare 6 minutes.
Lastly, Philip Lariche says, since gravitational waves are extremely difficult to detect, I'm wondering just how much energy they might carry. If our eyes were as sensitive to gravitational radiation as they are to light, how bright would gravitational waves be?
They'd be surprisingly bright. The reason they're difficult to detect is because gravity only barely acts with the matter compared to the electromagnetic force that allows us to see. Now, you've experienced that if you've ever used a small magnet to lift something against the gravitational pull of the entire Earth. But gravity isn't a force to be trifled with. Its strength lies in the fact that it's the only fundamental force that can't be negative. And while very little of the universe has a perceptible charge, everything with mass exerts gravity. Which means there's a lot of gravity floating around in the universe compared to a small amount of light. So how strong is a gravitational wave? Since we haven't detected any yet, that's a hard thing to say for sure. But one of the best tests of gravitational radiation we have is the double pulsar, the orbit of which spirals in by 76.5 microseconds per year, emitting 7 trillion terawatts of energy as it does so. That's about 2% of the Sun's total output as gravitational waves. The double pulsar is about 6,400 parsecs away, so we'd see that as a rather faint 19th magnitude star. However, the double pulsar will continue to get brighter in gravitational waves for another 300 million years or so. It's hard to find an accurate estimate of what the peak flux would be. The best answer I've found suggests that they could be up to 10 billion times stronger, making them, in comparative terms, as bright as the planet Venus, with a bolometric magnitude of -4. Unfortunately, the problem with visualizing gravitational waves is that our eyes are very well tuned to a small frequency range. The gravitational waves are produced with a frequency equal to the two bodies' orbits, Even at the point of merger, these gravitational waves will all be of a longer frequency than any radio waves detectable from Earth. So to any earthly observer, we'd still see nothing.